At Speedway, we've always been here to get you what you need when you need it. We're committed to keeping our stores open, clean, and safe, so you can stay fueled and refreshed all summer long. We've got cold drinks for hot days and frozen drinks for even hotter ones, plus energy boosts, quick bites, and pick-me-ups. We're always on your way, and we're always here for you. So no matter what you need, when you stop by, we'll be ready. Now, any Speedy Freeze up to Mighty Size is just 99 cents.
Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Catch us on iTunes or visit audiogyan.com for more Gyan sessions. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
I love this book called What is Art and 100 Other Very Important Questions by Ernst Billgren. One of his questions in his book is, who decides whether art is good or not? And then he has a nice format to answer. There's a short answer and a long answer. So short answer is Glenn D. Laurie. And then the long answer, quality is moniker for what people you respect appreciate. Or even if you do not agree with them, there are those who you perceive as authorities in the field on account of their expertise, their position, or the respect they enjoy among peers. Subsequently, what is considered geniality changes as those people are substituted. The Pre-Raphaelites were considered the best thing that happened in the world of art, but well into the 20th century, nobody defended them any longer, and their work was automatically devalued as passé. The paintings themselves do not change over time. Quality is a relative term in similar ways as time, which feels absolute in the moment. Why am I talking about who decides whether art is good or not? Today, I have Ram Rehman with us on Audio Gyan, who needs no introduction. But just for the formality, Ram is a photographer, curator, designer, activist, and a noted contemporary artist based in Delhi. With his such huge body of work, it's impossible to document even a fraction of his thoughts or ideologies and philosophies. But I'm just going to try and document one aspect and have a conversation around curation. So welcome, Ram sir, to Audio Gyan. It's a real, real honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for asking me, Kedar. I'm happy to be on this and give whatever gyan I can.
Wow. Thanks a lot. The overall premise of the conversation, I wanted to just understand what is curation, and that's why this particular quote as well. So if you can help us start by like just giving some background about what, like, how old is this concept of curation? I mean, as human species, or as civilized humans, or I mean, what made us do that? If we can start with that, and then I have like a couple of more questions ahead.
Gosh, you know, on the subject of curation, there are probably many academics who would be specialists in the history of, you know, what you're talking about is the concept and the meaning of the word, because of course it comes out of, ultimately it comes out of Latin. I can't really answer that in an academic or way, but I can answer it as a practitioner, as a photographer, and somebody who's, you know, grown up in the arts, both performing arts and architecture with my parents, and having watched the milieu of the arts, for me, curation really means putting together some work that you have found interesting, which may be performance, may be cinema, maybe photography, maybe painting, maybe architecture, and you want to share it with a wide audience. And my interest has always had a connection with history, which is, either economic history, political history, social history, all of which, of course, are completely interlinked. And what I have found interesting personally is to present work and contextualize it in at the time that it was being done, or if it is contemporary work, at the time that it's being made now, but I link it to social forces, historical forces, either in the past or in the present. And I, for me, I find that contextual link actually reinforces the creativity in any of these forms and makes it very interesting, because the forms keep changing over time and through history. So I hope that has a little bit of clarity.
Yeah, I mean, but if you can help understand with a particular example, if possible. I mean, how do you contextualize so that it will be...
Oh, sure. I mean, there are a number of examples, because I have, quite a long history of practice. But one of the more interesting and possibly lesser known ones was a number of years ago, my friend Ronesh Ray, who's an architect in Delhi, who came out of the School of Planning and Architecture. Actually, he was in school with me, in modern school before that. Ronesh was asked by Sonia Gandhi to design a memorial museum to Indira Gandhi in the house that she was lived in and where she was assassinated, which was 1 Safdarjung Road in Delhi. And Ronesh dragged me into the project as a photo researcher, photo archivist, and photo curator, and also co-designer in terms of how we would present the images. It was only 3 rooms in this not very large house, the 3 rooms that Rajiv and Sonia used to live in. Now, what I found very interesting about that project was you go through this incredible public archive, but a lot of it was actually a personal archive, which many people had not seen. A lot of material which belonged to the family. And of course, the fascinating thing about that was it was linked to the national movement. I mean, the material is coming out of a family which was completely, in a sense, one of the major spines of the freedom struggle. And putting that work together, thinking about, how you present it to a public, which is a very ordinary public, because you have, villagers who come in, who take their shoes off before they enter the house, because it's almost for them like a shrine. That was a fascinating project. And I found, putting that history and making it very personal. Sonia Gandhi had wanted it to be very personal with respect to Indira, and not as kind of official museum where you see her shaking hands with, 150 leaders, etc., but showing the human side of a very public politician who happened to be a very, very important figure. So that's what I mean about the context. I found working on that really exciting, because it was, in a sense, also a learning experience for me, because I learned about aspects of our history through this very personal project focused on Indira Gandhi, aspects that I would never have known about myself. And I find, for me, that's part of the excitement of curating something, is also learning myself and hopefully passing on some of that learning to the public.
Yeah, it's really amazing. But then, if I have to ask you, because obviously with Sonia Gandhi and Indira Gandhi, you have people who are telling you the real stuff, as in like whatever they experience. And this is quite recent in the timeline as well. When the history timeline is sort of many years before, maybe 100 years of years before. So, and plus there is also sort of every great figure or every particular event has a mythic truth and also like a real truth which must have happened. So is there any process to differentiate those, identify how to go about it?
Well, it actually, your question about a kind of mythic truth or a factual truth, You see, when you're dealing with more modern material, that question doesn't arise so much. Of course, you can, in terms of a figure like Indira Gandhi, you can say that there was a mythic aspect to her because of that huge public persona. But there is actually very factual material. So, you know, more contemporary work, even, say, going back to 100 years, you have a lot of facts that you can access and put before people. Now, when you go back in history much further, if you're going back many thousands of years, that becomes much harder. And, you know, the kind of mythology which gets attached to either real figures like the Buddha or mythic figures like Rama, after whom I'm named, that becomes much more problematic because you have very little actual factual information. You know, the their stories, their kathas, etc., are literary or poetic. The Buddha is very different because there are texts which are attributed to him, the Dashrath Jatak, etc., and particular speeches or teachings that he made, including at Sarnath. Or Jesus, who's a later figure than the Buddha. But in terms of art, you know, the interpretation of older art becomes the issue. Because you can look at, you know, a single painting, say a Dashavatar painting, etc., and analyze it through its beauty, its construction, its color. But then there's also the mythology of, you know, destroying a demon. What does that mean? So the interpretation in older work becomes much harder, but can also be very exciting because, you know, you get scholars who present it in a way which is their interpretation, and their interpretation might excite you to look at the work harder. And it doesn't necessarily mean that their interpretation is 100% correct, but it excites you enough to look at the work and maybe open your own thinking, your own ideas, your own analysis to make the work more interesting to yourself. And then, of course, you might have your own interpretation of that work. So with modern material, it's very different.
So what you're saying is, basically, you deal with whatever you have been presented with and as far as the research can go. I mean, there is no real process to reach the actual truth which has happened. It just... So I'll give you one more example. I was listening to this Zakir Hussain's interview where he said that a lot of these bandishes or different formats of reading a particular tal was used to change. Now, if... Now, he gave a timeline saying that I don't know anything beyond, say, 120, 130 years ago.
Right.
I mean, that's what I can go up to. And beyond that is just my interpretation, my reading. So is that a similar case in, say, painting or these sort of artifact type stuff which gets curated?
Well, you see, music and dance, the performing arts, the recording of the performing arts is very recent. So you don't actually have performance records, either of music or dance, that go back very, very far. Now, when you're talking about painting, you see, what is the period that manuscripts or paintings or canvases actually survive from? If you look at our own art history, sculpture lasts because it is made of solid material. It is either carved in stone or cast in metals or bronze, or sometimes made with terracotta, which is a little more fragile material but can also last for quite a long time. The ancient art which has lasted has usually been fresco painting. And in our case, like the Ajanta caves or some of the beautiful paintings in the monasteries in Ladakh, or the other Himalayan regions, the Buddhist monasteries, or some of the paintings in the temples in South India. Now, those last because they're actually painted on architectural surfaces. Now, this whole question of, there's so much art, obviously, that was lost that we haven't seen. So it's very difficult to extrapolate, where Ajanta came out of, because it's a very sophisticated visual tradition. And obviously, there must have been many streams of art practice happening at the time, which led to that fantastic creation of Ajanta. But we don't know that, and we can't know that, because that's lost.
And with real, not with more recent stuff which you mentioned about, so how has that definition of something unique, something curate worthy, I don't know whether that's a word also, but yeah, something to be put in context and then shared it with more people, how has that definition changed within your 30-40 years of work? Because it a lot of times it happens, right? So you find more dots connecting and then you re-architect the entire thing. So if you can share any particular...
That is a complex question. For instance, the British ruled us for 200-something years. They gave us the language which we are speaking now, English. And they imposed study of art, study of architecture, etc., through the schools that they had built across India. So a lot of our, modern looking, our modern thinking in the visual arts or the plastic arts changed enormously. I mean, there was a huge difference between what was happening in the late Mughal period and when that culture faded, including with language or with music, which started, vanishing or hiding in smaller courts or even dance. I'm losing my train of thought here. But you were asking how something becomes important in terms of, say an iconic image or an iconic building or an iconic painting.
Correct. Or if I have to just put like a opposite side of the question, that how, say, like unique, or how the concept of being different and worth of curating is like changing phenomena, how stable is this concept as well? I mean, if I have to ask the same question on the other side.
Well, you see, now with the explosion in communication and with new media, with the internet, with telephones, etc., which, when I started out, there was none of that. So if I wanted to research something, I would have to go into a library and see if I could find a book which had that material. And in India, it was very difficult to get international publications, particularly in the arts. Now you can reach out across the world at the click of a mouse or a click of your keyboard on your computer or even on the phone. You don't need a mouse or a computer. You can do it on your telephone, as long as you have access to a smartphone and access to internet, which is also something which is actually quite limited in a poor country like ours. So the question of, in our contemporary culture, you see, what is iconic in India in terms of art? One of the most iconic is, of course, the Ashoka lion from the column in Sarnath. Now, that is actually a work of art. It is a sculpture from thousands of years ago. It became adopted as the symbol of the state. Now, here is a work of art which everybody sees every day. It's on every note. It's on every coin. It's on every letterhead, Now, there is something which became iconic, and it is an incredible piece of sculpture. as a work of art. If you have seen it, it's in the museum in Sarnath.
Yeah, I've seen that.
It's really beautiful and beautifully carved, and you know, it's a stunning work of art. But it became an icon because it was designated as such. I'm trying to think in our culture, you know, you think of the Nataraj figure.
Correct.
From Chola sculpture. Now, there are many different Nataraj sculptures, some of which become more famous than others because of their proportion, their scale, their, you know, mood that they convey. But that is an icon, you know, that figure of the Nataraj dancing in that circle of fire is recognized by almost anybody across the country. In modern times, I would say, you know, possibly Rabindranath Tagore, some images, there's that image of that woman with the Orni over her head, which is a portrait which many, many people know. And that's associated, of course, with the figure of Tagore, who's a very highly complex figure in our national movement, with his writing, his poetry, his philosophy, his setting up of Shantiniketan. Otherwise, possibly, you know, someone like Hussein, who made images. Hussein, in his very persona, became a kind of iconic figure. And he was one artist who was known from the high society, from the highest echelons of our society, to a rickshawala. And I don't think there's any other artist who has had that reach. He had a reach down to the ground through sometimes very simple images. You know, I see him as a sort of folk painter, actually, a patwa painter. And I also see him actually as the first Sufi visual artist, because all the earlier Sufis have been poets or singers. They have, you know, articulated their link to the divine or to the nation or to the people through words. And I really see him as the first who articulated that connection through the visual. And I think what happens is, you know, there is a level of popular understanding which an image can reach out to people and grab your attention. And it becomes, you know, it becomes an iconic image. And it might happen, you know, recently when we've been watching this terrible migration of the labor from our cities into the countryside because of this situation that we're in with this coronavirus. There are a couple images that came out, really short films that came out on the net, which gripped people because, you know, it showed something and it moved them. And a couple, this image of those chapatis lying on the railway tracks, where those people were, the 15 or 17 who were run over by a train in the middle of the night in Maharashtra, or that boy who was on the suitcase being pulled by his mother on the road. Now, see, those have become kind of iconic, in a sense, artistic images which have reached out to millions of people and have touched them somehow. And they will remember those images. And I'm talking about them actually in a context of art, because here is a, you know, it may not have been very consciously made, but that's the great thing about the mobile phone, etc. Now is that sometimes you capture something, an image or a little bit of a film, which can move millions of people also in an artistic sense. And it's the power of that visual image which actually grips you. If you only read about it, it may not have had the kind of effect that just those few seconds of that image have had.
I'm just trying to digest what you said, but I want to then, I mean, understand that as in the Ashoka's pillar is sort of like a great work in itself, but is it, so how important is the curator's vision of including that and then making it mainstream? So one is the work itself speaks for itself, and it's phenomenal, it's poetic, it's everything, and then there is a curator also who spots that and then decides that it has to be an iconic part of our timeline, of our history, of our culture.
Well, you know, the Ashoka lion, I think, actually was suggested to Nehru by Laila Tayyabji's mother. And Laila's parents were prominent figures in the national movement. But talking about, you know, why and how you would choose something, I'll shift the discussion a little bit to modern architecture, which is something I think you were also interested in.
Correct.
And for instance, in 2013, I curated, I mean, that word is for me actually slightly problematic word, but in any case, that's the word which is used. I curated an exhibition of photographs of Delhi's modern architecture by Madan Mahata, who was the great photographer from the Mahata family which has had studios pre-partition in Rawalpindi, in Srinagar, and then finally set up in Delhi at partition. And they continued with their Srinagar studio. But Madan was the first, one of the first photographers to actually go abroad and study photography formally. He studied in England. And he comes back to Delhi in 1955, which is just at the moment when all the new architecture is being built in Delhi, much of it actually promoted by Nehru, who brought many of these architects to Delhi, like my father, whom he brought to Delhi from Calcutta, or Kanvinde, Achyut Kanvinde, who came from Bombay. But the amazing thing about Madan Mahata was that he was, first of all, a remarkable architectural photographer. And I realized that because I studied photography. I had known and knew Madan, you know, in my childhood. But at the more I studied in the US, the more I studied photography history and then started doing architectural photographs myself, I realized how fantastic Madan's work was. And that it was a very unique body of work because he photographed at the time when all these young architects were making this incredible body of modernist work in the city of Delhi. And uniquely, because Delhi had a lot of open land, because it was a new city, the new Delhi. And there was a lot of land available to build new buildings on a scale which is pretty unique for a new capital city. You know, it's only from the 50s until now. And I persuaded Madan, he was ill with cancer. I persuaded him, and I persuaded Devika Daulat Singh, who was running a very good photo gallery in Delhi, Photo Inc. And I got them together, and I put together this exhibition. Now, you see, the thing with that is that I knew the architecture, and I knew Madan's incredible photographs of that architecture. And I thought, my God, you know, we really need to put this out in the public because this is a very important document of a very important period of creativity in our modern movement. But it's also a very, very powerful piece of art because the photographs are so fantastic. And as I said, I've always been interested in that conjunction of in a sense, you could say beauty, history, and the moment. In this case, it was the moment of the building of the new India, the aspiration towards, going away from our colonial history, throwing away the shackles of that 200 years of British colonialism and coming into our own. So for me, in a sense, you know, I realized that that work was important to show. And actually, the exhibition had a huge impact. And when I first asked Madan to show it, he said that who would be interested? And I said, please just listen to me, because times have changed. And because of new technology, we were able to resurrect the old negatives and restore them and make these beautiful modern prints. And what happened was that it was for the first time that modern architecture shook the art world in India, because no one had really looked at contemporary architecture as part of the larger art project in India before that exhibition. So there is a perfect example of, you know, finding something by happenstance, because I happened to know him. I had studied architecture. I knew the architects. So it was complete happenstance. It wasn't something that I researched, you know, and discovered from outside. It came from inside.
Fascinating, fascinating. And if I have to just go slightly deeper and ask on the same lines that recently, I mean, this is mainly from a, like Ruturaj had recommended asking you this, that you've been recently speaking a lot about your father's work as well.
Right.
I mean, does that fall in the same timeline? And what makes you think that that stories have to be retold? I mean, I'll give you some background about my understanding as well, that I recently did one interview, which was sort of a biography of Vijay Tendulkar, spoken by Ramu Ramanathan. And what he said that in the 60s and 70s, Vijay Tendulkar, when he saw the Indira Gandhi's regime, he said that this is sort of a rehearsal to fascism.
The emergency.
Yeah, the emergency right. Time. And he made strong comments about the administration in general, the establishment. What I read from this is that these cycles keep happening. And again, that's what I have understood so far. But if you can help me understand that, do you also believe in that? I mean, the cycles of something good and then bad happening in a very cyclical manner.
It's difficult to look through history. I mean, historically, that has happened. And you had asked actually about my father.
Correct.
And why, you know, we can take it from there and get into the latter part of your query. You see, my father studied in the 1940s in the U.S., studied architecture. He was one of the first Indians to study architecture in the U.S. And he studied with many teachers, but very importantly with Walter Gropius, who had founded the Bauhaus. And you had asked that, you know, why is there now suddenly so much interest in the period either of my father's work or of that period in India in the 1950s? And the reason is actually quite clear, because 2019 was the centenary year of the founding of the Bauhaus in Germany. And it was a very unusual school, because it became the kind of harbinger of modernism in Europe. And what modernism meant was a new kind of building, a simplified architecture, which was aesthetically abstract and pleasing, but also incorporated new technology and was relatively cheap to build. So it fought against the high bourgeois capitalist architecture that most European cities had been built with. And the whole idea of the Bauhaus was to build for the people, for the laborers, for the working class, for lower middle class, and give them a kind of housing or work environment which was open, filled with light, with new glass, which was available, etc. So that was a philosophy that someone like Gropius expounded in MIT and in Harvard. My father had gone to MIT. And my father got very excited by that because it made complete sense to him, coming from a poor country like India, that this idealist basis of modern architecture is completely suited to us. So he comes here and he starts building in Calcutta, and Nehru sees his work there in the late 40s, 1949, and tells him to shift to the Central Public Works Department in Delhi. And my father remained as a government architect his whole life, unlike most of the architects who, some of whom started out in government work and then set up private practice. And what is important about that period, not just in my father's work, but a whole generation in the 50s, was that there was this incredible spark of idealism. And these people were building public buildings. The government was the biggest construction builder in India after independence. New housing was being built, new educational institutes, the IITs, the medical AIIMS, hospitals, cultural centers across India, theaters, libraries, and of course a huge amount of public housing. And all of this had quite a fantastic creative input by these young designers who were pretty much following modernist principles across India and especially in Delhi. And I think the reason that people find that interesting now is because that kind of idealism has been lost since we opened up in the 90s to this neoliberal economic regime. We started importing, you know, we became much more consumer society than we had been before. And that idealism has actually interested younger people now because it has kind of been lost. And it's also a historic moment because for a country like India, see, don't forget that India, you know, set up the non-aligned movement in the 1950s along with Egypt with Nasser and Tito and Yugoslavia. So India had this aspiration of leading older colonial nations out of colonialism. We were the first in 1947. We watched the whole of Africa gain independence right through, you know, into the 70s. And this cultural thrust of India actually was very important because it was part of that projection of modernist resistance. Modernism had a revolutionary link to it. It was left-wing. It was, anti-big business, anti-capitalist, if you can put it that way. So I think those aspects, which are deeper aspects of the philosophy than just looking at a building and saying, oh, it's very nicely designed, those are things that people have become very interested in now.
So, Ram sir, I would like to conclude because there's so much to talk that I don't know how
to go on for hours.
Yeah. So, just to conclude, if I have to ask you that, what's sort of the long-term future of curation, especially in the digital world? The boundaries are getting blur of what's real, what's put up, what is pseudo, and what has really got substance. So do you think, how do you envision the museums or the galleries or curated work of the future?
Well, there are many different things going on. You know, right now we're in the middle of the huge Black Lives Matter upheaval in the US, which has had repercussions across the world. Mm. Now, I was laughing because, you know, this whole idea of tearing down statues in the US because the figure that they want to remove was a slave owner who supported slavery in the American South and basically repressed or maybe even, you know, killed hundreds of what the Americans used to call Negroes or African blacks who had been brought over as slaves. Now, the funny thing is my grandfather in 1909 desecrated two Queen Victoria statues in Nagpur as a young revolutionary. And he was ratted on by somebody to the British and he had to flee India. And he landed up in the US and he could never return to British India until after independence. And because of that, his whole life changed. He met this American woman who was interested in Indian dance, married her. She became my grandmother. And I'm just laughing, you know, looking at the statue removal in the US now, thinking that, you know, here is this history that we have that goes back to our anti-colonial struggle. And we removed, you know, statues in India Gate and Delhi from many locations and took them all to Kingsway Camp. But I'm digressing a little bit because I think museums are now going to have to deal with, particularly Western museums, where so much of the art actually has been looted. And more people are now asking for that material to be returned. And some of it, of course, was looted, during colonial rule. A lot of African work is being slowly returned back to the tribes who made the work and to whom the work is important in terms of ritual or religion. And there's been a debate for a long time about Native American work in the US and Canada, which is lying in museums, which is again looted from the Native Americans. I think ultimately, you know, museums are going to have to deal with these histories. And in the situation that we're in now with this incredible pandemic, I think the economic consequences are going to be huge. So many people have lost their jobs. So many people have lost their savings. And I don't mean just the very poor. I mean, there are people, you know, who are upper middle class, etc., who are absolutely terrified because many of them have lost their jobs. Look at what's happening with the press in India, where hundreds and hundreds of journalists are being fired every day. One committed suicide today at All India Medical Institute because he lost his job and got infected with the virus. So we're facing an economic crunch right at the moment, which is going to have a huge impact on the art world in terms of the art market, etc. So it's very difficult to say, but I think the internet, you know, both has good aspects and bad aspects. A good aspect is that you can share work very, very quickly. Of course, it's not in person. It's on a computer screen or on a digital screen, which is not the same thing as holding an object in your hand or seeing a painting on the wall or on canvas. But I think the net will become more and more important. And I think it will, you know, in its own way, generate an aesthetic, which I don't see as a bad thing. I'm again listening, you know, we have just banned TikTok a few days ago because of this Chinese fracas in Ladakh. And I look at all these poor people in the villages who were making these little TikTok videos, and it had become a means of, in a sense, self-expression. Anybody could do it who had a, you know, a good enough phone, smartphone, and people actually went out and bought phones just to do this because some of them were actually making a bit of money when they got a lot of followers who were watching their little performance things on TikTok. So, you know, that generates a new kind of means of expression. So I think that'll happen, you know, it'll change. And museums will change. I think many museums actually are going to close because with this extended, God knows how long this virus is going to keep us all shut down. But I have a feeling it's going to be very, very long until a vaccine is found. It is going to completely disrupt the world as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about the expression part, I was just reading day before yesterday, there was one woman in some Bhopal or Kanpur. I don't remember the city exactly, but she was killed just because she had like 1.3 lakh followers on TikTok. I mean, it's a different story which is happening in different parts of the world. So yeah.
Gosh, that story I hadn't heard.
Yeah, it was very sad. All right, I think, this can just keep going on and on. And I'm really, really thankful to you for giving such great insights and sharing some of your knowledge on AudioGAN. So I'm really thankful. Before we sign off, I want to also thank Ruturaj from Matter. And this episode is in association with Matter. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. And I also thank Ruturaj because he had, where we first met, was at that fantastic symposium on modernist architecture in Goa.
Correct.
Which he had organized, I think, in August last year, which was really a remarkable symposium with fantastic speakers and very, very well organized. So I'm glad we met there and I'm glad we were able to do this. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Definitely. It was an honor speaking to you. Thank you.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.
Now that's a parking spot.
Introducing the I may have underestimated the size of my car policy with accident forgiveness from American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote. Find an agent. Visit amfam.com.
Optional policy features not included in base policies. Review policy for coverages and exclusions. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.